I want to talk about the age of Christ. These are the ages, this is the age between 12 and 30, more commonly referred to as the lost years by a lot of scholars. That's a period of 18 years in Christ's life that we virtually know nothing about. At the age of 12, Jesus was at the Passover with his parents, and this is the last reference to Jesus in the Bible. As you recall, he was among the teachers in the temple. This is out of Luke chapter 2:52. After his parents found him in the temple and they proceeded back to his home, is the last mention of Jesus. The last verse says, "And Jesus increased in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and man." Next reference to Jesus in the Bible is when he began his ministry, and that's Luke chapter 3, verse 23. It says he was about 30 years of age. There's nothing in the apocryphal literature, or pseudepigrapha. These are books like the Apocrypha that have false authors. There's nothing really significant in those books that talk about years of Christ between the age of 12 and 30. He's thought to have been in Palestine in or about Nazareth, employed as a carpenter. That was the tradition in those times. It was to follow your father's trade. That's where this idea comes from. There are no facts to support this hypothesis. Traditional position taken by Christian theologians and scholars is that Jesus was in or about Nazareth, and nothing was written because he didn't do anything noteworthy to report during this time. Intuitively, I feel that that's hard to follow, because being such a great man, I can't see how he could spend 18 years doing nothing significant. So I begin searching for an answer to an age-old mystery. The first theory I wanted to talk about comes from a book that I found in the Holden Library. It's by Charles Potter. It's called The Lost Years of Jesus. Charles Potter published this book first in 1958. His theory was that Jesus spent the lost years among the Essene people of Qumran. I'm going to write this on the board so you can remember. Basic theory. Okay, who were the Essenes? That's a good question. I wanted to read from his book what Josephus, who was one of the early historians, he was a Greek historian, said about the Essene community. The Essenes were a group of people that lived in Palestine area near the Dead Sea, and they had a large community. It was a community mostly of men. This is what Josephus wrote about Qumran. They despise wealth, and their socialism is remarkable. None among them can be found richer than another. It is their law that all who enter the sect must divide their property among the members of the society, with the result that there is never seen among them either abject poverty nor great wealth. for since every man's possessions are put into the common treasury, they all have, like brothers, one inheritance. Another early historian, Pliny is his name, he was a contemporary with Josephus, he visited the Qumran community and he wrote this account. On the west side of the Dead Sea and far enough away to escape its noxious fumes are the Hessians, a race by themselves and remarkably different from all other men in the whole wide world. They live without women. There's a footnote there. When they excavated the ruins of the Essenes, they found 1,200 graves, six of which were women and the rest were men. So there were a few women there. Having renounced all sexual love, they lived without money, and for companionship, they have palm trees. The ranks are continually recruited from the numbers of people who, weary from struggling with adverse fortune, resort to this way of living. So strange to say, without any births among them, this race has lasted for thousands of ages, because so fruitful for them is the life weariness of others. Pliny's enthusiasm for the Essenes comes out in this, and he said that they lasted for thousands of years, but actually the community only existed for a very short period. It was founded around 135 to 76 before Christ, and the Qumran community was destroyed by the Roman 10th Legion in 68 AD, so it had a life of approximately 100 years or so, or 150 years. The Essenes held this community by the Dead Sea. Further on, Pliny says, there are still God-guided men today who live naturally and reasonably, men who are themselves so free that they inspire their neighbors also with the spirit of freedom. There are not so many of them, it is true, but that is not to be wondered at, for high nobility of that degree is always rare. These men have attained to it by separating themselves from the common crowd, that they may dedicate their lives to the study of the great truths of nature. Okay, we've all heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Essenes are the people that were responsible for the Dead Sea Scrolls. The scrolls were first discovered in 1958 in a cave near Qumran. And since then, it was 1948, and they've, over a period of years until 1956 roughly, they discovered 10 caves with thousands of scrolls. Another book from Holden Library. In this book, it's called Archaeological Discoveries in the Holy Land. And they have pictures of the excavations of Qumran in here. This article is written by Frank M. Cross, who's written books about the Dead Sea Scrolls. He's a Hancock professor of Hebrew and other Oriental languages and chairman of the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Literatures at Harvard. He's a member of the international staff editing the Dead Sea Scrolls. I wanted to read some things from this book. Recent explorers had supposed that this Essene community was a small Roman fort. It had been known about for a long time, but when they found the Dead Sea Scrolls, they went back to this ruin and excavated it and discovered the Essene people. It says here, thanks to a combination of literary evidence, not least that of the adjacent caves and spectacular archaeological data, the identity of the site as the Essene community center or city in the wilderness has been established beyond reasonable doubt. The Essenes were the historian J. Josephus, third party in Judaism in the time of Jesus Christ, an apocalyptic community competing with the more conservative Sadducees and Pharisees for the allegiance of pious Jews. It says in the first two seasons of excavation, they found a fortified tower, common rooms for study, storage, and work, including a scriptorium. That's where they wrote many of the scrolls. In the scriptorium was a plaster writing table, some 5 meters long, ink pots, benches, and bases for ritual washing. It is probable that at least some of the manuscripts in the caves came from this center. The fact that manuscripts from caves both north and south of the site are on occasion written by a single scribe support this supposition. So the Essene people are well established by scientists of today. The Dead Sea Scrolls contain many, many writings. I wanted to see what's listed here. It's really, at this time of this writing, a complete catalog is not available. In one cave alone, in Cave 4, they found approximately 90 manuscripts that were biblical. That was 1/3 of the manuscripts that were found in that cave. All the books of the Old Testament were found in this cave. Many copies of the book of Isaiah. There was one book of the Old Testament that wasn't in there. It was the book of Esther. Another large portion of the manuscripts belong to the category of apocryphal and books with false authors works. And most of this material was in the original Semitic garb, they call it. It's a old language. There was another group of sectarian works, hymns, and rules of discipline that the community lived by. There were commentaries on a large number of Old Testament books. Miscellaneous documents that were wholly unknown previously were found also. There were 10 copies of the books of Enoch found in Cave 4. This is important. We'll talk specifically about the book of Enoch later on. The importance of this find is that we have some kind of tangible evidence to work with here. The scrolls do exist. There's no question about that. And it's just a matter of translating them. Most of the manuscripts that were found antedate by more than 1,000 years the traditional Hebrew text, which has been the basis of our English Bible. The book of Isaiah, in particular, is talked about a lot in here. Of course, all the books of the Old Testament were found. I'm sorry, I didn't define myself before when I said Bible. Only the books of the Old Testament are involved here. The community has been dated around the time of Christ, so of course the New Testament wasn't written yet. These are the oldest copies of the Bible that we know of today. Another importance of the find, I feel, is that the translations have been done by language scholars, such as Frank Cross of Harvard University, who is a language scholar, rather than being done by theologians who may doctor their translations to fit their own views. Also in here, they talk. Frank Cross talks about parallels between the Essenes and Jesus. He says, if there are but superficial parallels between the Essene teacher and Jesus of Nazareth, there are intimate parallels between the Essene and primitive Christian communities. These are to be found in their theological language, in their theology of history, in their liturgical institutions, and in their ecclesiastical organization. In these areas, the Essene documents are radically important for our understanding of Christian origins. The central sacraments of the Essene Church were its baptism and its communion meal. The baptism of the Essenes, like that of John, was upon repentance of sins into the eschatological community. Contrary to the early Christian institution, the Essenes seem to have practiced continual lustrations as well as baptism on initiation into the covenanted community. In the liturgy of the communion meal of the Essenes, we discover material of the first importance for understanding the Eucharistic practice of the Church today. Okay, I want to talk about the Book of Enoch, the books of Enoch. This is a very important book, according to Potter and his theories about Jesus being among the Essenes. The most important part about the Book of Enoch that scholars are able to see, or obvious thing, is the common theological language between this book and the New Testament. Some of the books in the Book of Enoch are written about the wars between the fallen angels, and apparently 200 fallen angels who developed insatiable lust for the daughters of men. They fell to earth out of lust and took the daughters of the sons of men as wives and begat children. There were wars between the sons of light and the sons of darkness. One of the angels that led the sons of light was said to be Gabriel. This is what Enoch and scholar Dr. R.H. Charles says. There's abundant proof that the early Christian approval of the Book of Enoch. Over 100 phrases in the New Testament find earlier precedents in the Book of Enoch. Familiar themes like the many mansions of the Father's house and the woe unto you that are rich, the vengeance of God on behalf of his elect, and the righteous becoming as angels in heaven tie the Bible to the Book of Enoch together. At the turn of the 20th century, the influence of Enoch on the New Testament has been greater than that of all other apocryphal and books with false authors taken altogether. Although scarce few have even heard of the influential book until the modern era, Dr. Charles points out that all the writers of the New Testament were familiar with it and were more or less influenced by it in thought and diction. Okay, I know in winter program that they've talked some about the apocryphal literature. The Book of Enoch is not listed with any lists of apocryphal literature that I've found. It seems to be a book that was hidden in old times and is hidden now also. I think it's a very important book that we probably should look into. There's a Catholic scholar on the Dead Sea Scrolls, J.T. Millick. He's quite well known for his works on the Dead Sea Scrolls. Millick notes the obviously close interdependence of the story of the fallen angels in Enoch and the story of the sons of God in the Book of Genesis, but he does not draw the conclusion drawn by the Church Fathers, namely that the Book of Enoch misinterpreted the earlier Genesis account and was therefore irrelevant. Millick rather arrives at this surprising yet well-justified conclusion that not only is the history of the fallen angels in Enoch older than Genesis 6, but Genesis 6 is in fact a direct summary of the earlier Enoch account. So Millick feels that chapter 6 in the Book of Genesis was actually derived from the Book of Enoch. want to go back to this book for a minute. So Potter basically feels that because of the similar language in the Bible, that the Essene influence of the early Christians was much greater than we suspect. He also says that in the letters of discipline that were found in the caves, you will also find the Sermon on the Mount given by Jesus Christ. He feels that many of the words that are credited to Christ were actually things that came from the Essene peoples. And he feels that Christ was an Essene, and that perhaps when he addressed people at the Sermon on the Mount, they knew he was an Essene, and that they understood that he was quoting Essene scriptures. This is what he writes here in the last part here. "We know if we had read the reports in French, German, and Hebrew scientific journals..." Many of the translations of the Dead Sea Scrolls have been done in French and other languages because it became an international project to do the translation. It says, "If we read these journals, that these pre-Christian Essenes must be accorded priority on much that has hitherto been thought original in Christianity. Their scriptures not accredited in our Bible can be read, and have been, in Christian Sunday morning services of worship without the congregation suspecting the substitution." In other words, he's saying that all along we've been studying Essene works and really didn't know it. "A century or more before the Christian New Testament was written, the Qumran Essenes were familiar with the ideas, teachings, proverbs, prayers, beatitudes, blessings, and even the beautiful sentences in Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, which he was quoting from Essene scrolls, as he and his audience knew, though we may not." Now, the time period of the Essenes as being these scrolls being written before Christ is definitely documented scientifically. The scrolls are dated, and they were pre-Christ that they were written. Okay, this is what I want to finish up with here. He says, "And now that the proven mother of Christianity is known to have been the prior community of the New Covenant, commonly called the Essenes, the momentous question challenging the conscience of all Christendom is whether the child will have the grace, courage, and honor to acknowledge and honor its own mother." Okay, Potter has some, in this book, he establishes some very interesting ideas, and he theorizes that Christ was an Essene, yet there's nothing written to support his idea. Also, he's very critical of the early church fathers, particularly of the 4th century fathers of the Nicene Creed. He's also very critical of modern theologians and the church for not searching further into this information and letting it be known to us. I really didn't come here tonight to talk about conspiracies and that. This has been the most uncomfortable part of my whole study, is this book here. Because if we just want to talk about conspiracies and that, well, then we'll generate anger and fear, and we won't learn anything from all this. I think we need to approach a subject like this with a very open mind. Sometimes we read things that, you know, we really don't want to hear, but we got to keep our mind open and keep searching, or we're not going to learn anything. So I'm going to put the lid on this for right now. I think that to really look into this, a person would need to read the translations of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And I'm really not a Bible scholar myself, but I intend in the future to look further into this theory. It's just one of many that I've found. For right now, I'm going to let it go. And I wanted to say, read this out of another book, and this is a much more refreshing idea, and I hope we can move forward with this. Why didn't anyone make a more complete record of Jesus' life? Scholars have given considerable thought to that question. Dr. John C. Trevor, director of the Dead Sea Scrolls Project of the School of Theology at Claremont, California, believes that the dearth of information is an irony of history, the natural sociological result of a people who are not oriented academically or historically, but religiously. He's saying that they didn't write everything down like we do in those times. You know, we can find out what Teddy Roosevelt ate for breakfast on May 3rd, 1950, and we document and write down everything. And he's saying that in the old times of history, they didn't write everything down. And also, you might think Christ did many, many wonderful things, and if it was all written down, it would be quite a job to write it all. So there's a lot of different theories. I'm going to move into a new area that's been a lot more interesting and fun for me, and a lot less threatening, I'm sure, for most of us. Nicholas Notovich was a Russian adventurer. He was born in the Crimea in 1858. In 1887, he was traveling in Asia, and he discovered an ancient Buddhist manuscript while he was traveling in Ladakh, that's Little Tibet. He said, the manuscript, is written only a few years after the death of Christ, and the manuscript explicitly says where Jesus was during the last years. He was in India, according to this. I'm going to write that down so you can remember a second. Okay, so Nicholas Notovich found this ancient manuscript in Ladakh, that's Little Tibet. Now, Tibet, if you can picture India in your mind, at the top of India is Nepal, and the Himalayas are above that. On the other side of the Himalayas is Tibet. Okay, Nicholas Notovich wrote 11 books. He was somewhat of a writer, but he wrote books on Russian affairs of state and international relations. This is the only book he wrote of any religious nature whatsoever. In 1894, he published the first book of his account in the French language. He called it The Life of Saint Issa, the best of the sons of men. Now, Saint Issa is a word in Asia that was used for Jesus. That's how it's spelled. Okay, following the Russo-Turkish War of 1887-78, he began a series of travels in the East. He was interested in the people and the archaeology of India. He wandered his way around to Kashmir, finally, and then crossed the Himalayas into Ladakh. Ladakh is called Little Tibet, and in those times it was a separate kingdom of Tibet and was actually looked at as a separate country other than Tibet. Now it's all considered to be one country of Tibet. Okay, he wrote a fascinating travel log of this adventure journey that he took. He crossed the high mountain pass into upper Ladakh, and he came through an area where there were a lot of wild animals and that. And one of his coolies was attacked. It was dark. They were trying to get to the summit, and it got dark on him. And one of his coolies was attacked and killed by a panther, just a few feet from where he was standing. He traveled on narrow paths with extreme drop-offs, and it was really quite an adventure. And it's one of the more exciting parts. It's like a bonus when you're studying something to come into a travel log like this. You can imagine in 1887, it was quite a bit different traveling there than it is now. And even now, I think it's quite an adventure to go to Tibet. He wrote about also about the people of Ladakh, and they practice polyandry. The women took several husbands, and it's a pretty interesting account of that. When he got up in there, he visited a Buddhist monastery of Mobek. It's said to be the gateway. Mobek is the gateway to Tibetan Buddhism. At Mobek, a Buddhist lama told him that at the archives of Lhasa, Lhasa was the capital of Tibet, the main Tibet country that we know. And it's also the home of the Dalai Lama. This Buddhist Lama told him that in their archives they had several thousand ancient scrolls discovering the life of the prophet Issa. So Notovitch got real interested in this, and he set out for Lhasa on his way, and it was quite a journey to get there, and he never actually really made it. On the way, he visited other monasteries, and finally he arrived at Haimus. This was the largest monastery in Little Tibet, and there at Haimus he found copies of these scrolls. The way it worked with him is he had to use a lot of diplomacy, and I know this too from being among Asians and the Buddhist monks. He couldn't show too much enthusiasm, or they probably wouldn't have shown him the scrolls. They don't trust, and he had to be really cool about the whole thing. So he stayed at Haimus for a while, and finally someone there mentioned that there were copies of the scrolls there, and they taught the holy doctrine of Jesus, teachings in India and among the children of Israel. He left Haimus and said that he would like to return someday, and asked if they would show him the scrolls. And soon after he left the monastery, he was thrown from his horse and broke his leg. And so that kind of gave him a reason to return, sort of an excuse. And he went back to Haimus to recover and went under the care of the monks there and spent quite a bit of time recovering from his accident. While he was there, he was shown the scrolls, and an interpreter translated the text for him. According to the lamas, the documents were brought from India to Nepal and then to Tibet. The originals were written in Pali. It's a religious language of the Buddhas, and actually it was a language of Upper India, Pali. The copy at Haimus had been translated to Tibetan language. The manuscript contained a bibliography of Issa, he describes this manuscript as composed of isolated verses, untitled and scattered out of sequence. Notovitch grouped the verses and put them in order, then published a document several years later, along with his account of the discovery. It's not a long work. It's 244 verses and 14 chapters. This document doesn't only tell about the last years of Christ, it tells about his entire life, from his birth until his crucifixion. This legend is still believed with much reverence among the Tibetan people in this region of the world today. More modern anthropologists and that support Notovitch's story. So let's read some of this manuscript and see what it says. Where was Jesus according to this document? This is how it starts out. The earth that's trembled in the heavens have wept because at the great a great crime which has been committed in the land of Israel, for they have tortured and there put to death the great and just Issa, in whom dwelt the soul of the universe, which was incarnate in a simple mortal in order to do good to men and to exterminate their evil thoughts, and in order to bring back man degraded by his sins to a life of peace, love, and happiness, and to recall to him the one and indivisible Creator, whose mercy is infinite and without bounds. Hear what the merchants from Israel relate to us on this subject. Okay, apparently there were merchants in Israel that witnessed the crucifixion of Christ, and in their return to India, they told the story of this event, and it was recorded in India. According to this manuscript, Jesus was known and loved very much in India. So when the story was told, there was great interest in India to record it. He also talks in the beginning of the manuscript about Moses. The Pharaoh had two sons, of whom the younger was called Moses. Learned Israelites taught him diverse sciences, and they loved Moses in Egypt for his goodness and the compassion which he showed to all those who suffered. It goes on to talk about Moses, and it's similar to the Old Testament accounts. Okay, now we get into Issa's life when he was at the age of 13. When Issa had attained the age of 13 years, the epoch when an Israelite should take a wife, the house where his parents earned their living by carrying on a modest trade began to be a place of meeting for rich and noble people, desirous of having for a son-in-law the young Issa, already famous for his edifying discourses in the name of the Almighty. Then it was that Issa left the parental house in secret, departed from Jerusalem, and with the merchant set out towards Sindh. Sindh is in India. He left with the object of perfecting himself in the divine word and studying the laws of the great Buddhas. In the course of his 14th year, the young Issa, blessed of God, came on this side of the Sindh and established himself among the Aryas in the land of the beloved God. Fame spread the reputation of this marvelous child throughout the length of the modern Sindh. Okay, he first came among the worshippers of the god of Jain, and they asked him to stay and study with them. The Jains were people sort of a cross between Buddhists and the Hindus that we know. Briefly, that's who they were. He didn't stay among the Jains, but traveled on to Jagannath in the country of Orissa. Okay, Jagannath is also Jagannath. There's an ancient temple in ruin there, and it is the heart and seat of Hindu philosophy, and even to this time is a very sacred city. He was welcomed in Jagannath, and the priests of Brahma made him welcome. Now, Brahmanism is what we call Hinduism, and according to the text, he passed 6 years at Jagannath, and also he traveled around Rajgriha and at Benares. Benares is a famous and holy city of the Ganges River Valley in India, where Buddha gave his first speech of enlightenment to his disciples. He traveled around other holy cities in that area. Now, Jesus studied among the Brahmins, and there is where he supposedly learned healing arts. And many of the Vedas that he studied of the Brahmins and those things helped him in his knowledge of the spiritual way. He ran into trouble there because the Brahmins have four classes of people that they live in a caste structure, and he attacked that. He didn't like that. He said God created all men equal, and so he fell among the Sudras. And the Sudras were a lower class of people, and he taught them, and he spent much time with the simple people, the farmers, and that. And it caused a lot of problem for him because he was a highly respected person, apparently. And the priests were very offended by this. And they became so angry, actually, that they plotted to kill him. And Issa, it says here, but Issa was warned of his danger by the Sudras and left the neighborhood of Jagannath by night, reached the mountain, and established himself in the country of the Gautamites. Gautamites were the followers of Buddha. His name was Gautama Buddha. After having perfected himself in the Pali language, the just Issa applied himself to the study of the sacred writings of the sutras. 6 years after, Issa, whom the Buddha had elected to spread the holy word, had become a perfect expositor of the scrolls of the sacred writings. He then left Nepal and the Himalayan mountains, descended into the valley of Rajputana, and went towards the west, preaching to diverse peoples the supreme perfection of man. So Jesus studied in Nepal, apparently, after he left the Hindus. He studied with the Buddhists for 6 years. Then he descended into the valley of Rajputana. This is where he traveled into Tibet. And actually, he traveled into the area where Notovitch claims he found his scrolls. This is, some of these areas are just referred to as the pagan territories. The divine Issa taught that the worship of visible gods was contrary to the law of nature. Okay, finally, Christ, in his travels and teachings, ended up in Persia. In Persia, the priest the priest became alarmed and forbade the inhabitants to listen to him. He caused a lot of trouble in Persia also. He's on his way back towards Jerusalem. In Persia, he ran into a bit of trouble. They actually arrested Jesus and put him on trial, and the holy men and the judges of those times decided to let him go and not to hurt him. But it says here that they put him outside the walls of the city where they hoped he would be consumed by wild beasts. But protected by the Lord our God, Saint Issa continued his way unmolested. Okay, this is the part where Issa returns to Israel and begins his ministry. Issa, whom the Creator had elected to remind a depraved humanity of the true God, had reached his 29th year when he returned to the land of Israel. Since his departure, the pagans had inflicted still more atrocious sufferings on the Israelites, who were a prey to the deepest despondency. Many among them had already begun to abandon the laws of their God and those of Moses, in the hope of appeasing their savage conquerors. In the face of this evil, Issa exhorted his compatriots not to despair, because the day of the redemption of sins was at hand, and he confirmed them in belief which they had in the God of their fathers. Okay, so what I've done is I've tried to give you a real fast idea of what this book contains. Jesus traveled, according to this, through Afghanistan and Persia into India, and he studied with the Hindus for 6 years. Then he went to India and studied with the Buddhists and for 6 years there also. It's clear in this writing that Jesus didn't only study, he taught. He was accepted with open arms by the great masters. They knew who he was. They could see that he was a man that had been gifted by the grace of God. And he taught them as well as they taught him, according to this book. Okay, we have a little bit of time left. I didn't know if I could fit all this in. say the least, when Notovitch published this book, it was controversial. He was attacked by scholars and critics of his time. Also, the Times wrote articles about him, and his original book was really shoved under the table. It exposed a lot of new information that people weren't ready for. Like I said, it talks about his entire life and teachings and his crucifixion, and some of the detail in there is quite shocking, actually, and very interesting. He was particularly attacked by Max Müller. He was a professor of modern European languages at Oxford. Max Müller tried to destroy Notovitch, said that he invented and fabricated this whole story and that he wrote the scripts and that he reported. But there have been many people who have returned and verify Notovitch's story. Swami Abhidananda was born in Calcutta in 1886. He was a highly esteemed and educated scholar of Sanskrit, versed in the literature of East and West. He was a follower of Ramakrishna. Okay, in 1897 and 1921, Abhidananda traveled extensively in the United States, Canada, and Mexico and lectured in almost every major American city. He was a friend of Max Müller, the Oxford professor that attacked Notovitch. He was curious about Notovitch's story, and when he did finally return to India in 1922, he went up to Ladakh to see if the story was true for himself. And indeed, he said that it was. It says, in 1922, I went to Tibet from Kashmir, crossing the Himalayas on foot to study the manners, customs, and Buddhist philosophy and Lamanism which prevail among the Tibetan Lamas. I went along Yarkand Road, the highway to Europe, and stopped at Leh, the capital of Ladakh in western Tibet. My destination was Haimus Monastery, about 25 miles north of the city of Leh. Abhidananda recorded the events of his journey in Kashmir and Tibet. That was the name of his book, In Kashmir and Tibet. Here he writes that after a tour of the monastery, he asked the lamas about the veracity of Notovitch's tale. It was then that he learned from them that the account was indeed true. Okay, Abhidananda translated the scrolls for himself and wrote his own account of what they contained. He published a book in India in the Bengali language. That book has never been available in any translation until 2 months ago when this book was published. Elizabeth Clare Prophet writes this book. It's called The Lost Years of Jesus. She's really done her homework in here. Abhidananda is one account. There are many other noted scholars who put very little doubt on the fact that those scrolls exist and that their contents are accurate, you know, the reports are accurate. Since the Chinese takeover of Tibet and reported destruction of the monasteries there, the Dalai Lama left Tibet. The hope of returning to search for the original scrolls and perhaps maybe carbon dating them, at this time, it seems remote. I really feel, from my reading, that there is no. The big question isn't really where are the scrolls, or did they exist? I think the evidence strongly shows us and supports that these scrolls did exist and do exist. The question here that I've come up to at this point with the study on this is what was the source of these scrolls? That's the thing that we really don't know. And the lamas have their explanations and there's other theories about it, but we don't know what was the real source of these scrolls. I really feel that they were found and they do exist. One theory is that perhaps Thomas wrote those scrolls because he was in India and he did have a small group of Christian followers near Jagannath where Christ was said to be. That's just something that we really don't know right now. Tomorrow night I want to talk about some other material not related to either of these two theories, at least in their source, but that will support I think a lot of things that we've talked about tonight. We have a little bit of time left. I wanted to read something that was kind of one of my favorite things from the scrolls about Jesus here. Okay, apparently the Tibetan people speak in great reverence of this legend of Issa. And one reason that they respected Jesus so much was because of his teachings. And I wanted to read a teaching from here that Jesus was said to have given. This was after he returned to Jerusalem. And this is concerning women. There were some spies that Pilate had sent out, and they were present one day when Jesus was teaching. It says, an old woman who had approached the group, the better to hear Issa, was pushed aside by one of the spies who placed himself before her. Then Issa held forth, "It is not meet that a son should set aside his mother, taking her place. Whosoever respecteth not his mother, the most sacred being after his God, is unworthy of the name of son. Listen then to what I say unto you. Respect woman, for she is the mother of the universe, and all the truth of divine creation lies in her. She is the basis of all that is good and beautiful, and she is also the germ of life and death. On her depends the whole existence of man, for she is his natural and moral support. She gives birth to you in the midst of suffering. By the sweat of her brow she rears you, and until her death you cause her the gravest anxieties. Bless her and worship her, for she is your one friend, your one support on earth. Respect her, uphold her. In acting thus you will win her love and her heart. You will find favor in the sight of God, and the many sins shall be forgiven you. In the same way, love your wives and respect them, for they will be mothers tomorrow, and each later on the ancestress of the race. Be lenient towards women. Her love ennobles men, softens his hardened heart, tames the brute in him, and makes him a lamb. The wife and the mother are the inappreciable treasures given unto you by God. They are the fairest ornaments of existence, and of them shall be born all the inhabitants of the world. Even as the God of armies separated of old the light from the darkness and the land from the waters, women possess the divine facility of separating in a man good intentions from evil thoughts. Wherefore I say unto you, after God your best thoughts should belong to the woman and the wives. Woman being for you the temple wherein you will obtain the most easily perfect happiness. Imbue yourselves in this temple with moral strength. Here you will forget your sorrows and your failures, and you will recover the lost energy necessary to enable you to help your neighbor. Do not expose her to humiliation. In acting thus, you would humiliate yourselves and lose the sentiment of love without which nothing exists here below. Protect your wife in order that she may protect you and all your family, and that you do for your wife, your mother, for a widow or another woman in distress, you will have done unto your God." I think that that's why Jesus is respected highly among the Tibetans. They always mention, at least in modern anthropologists, Jesus' views on women and the miracles and things like that. Well, I think I'm about out of time, so I'm going to stop for now. Tomorrow we'll look at a couple other theories.